we left off, we finished the eight classes above, and then we have reached a section on the 10. Okay, so 10?
10.
10?
10.
10 means something upon which something is based. So like this is
to be what?
This would be the 10 supporting the 10. The eraser would be under the 10. So this is the 10. This is called the Denbai, and it's spelled differently. But the 10 is the thing that's providing the foundation. In Vinaya, 10 can refer to an appropriate body and mind to take the vows. So if you're a 10, you can take Pratimoksha vows. And if you're not a 10, you cannot take Pratimoksha vows. For example, animals cannot take Pratimoksha vows. You have to be a human. Only human, of the five realms, only humans can take Pratimoksha vows. Not even plants can take Pratimoksha vows. A heart cannot become a gemo, or gemoma, a deva, a pleasure being. That's because they cannot have required motivation for taking them, which is fun. You can't be sick of life because their life is too fun. Right? Seriously. So in any realm where they're having too smooth of a life, they are not a den for Pratimoksha vows. In any realm where they have too much, like the hell realms, they cannot take Pratimoksha vows. Although they have some kind of natural renunciation. And then if they're too stupid, in the case of animals or pretas or things like that, they cannot. It's not a mental thing. They can't understand why they're taking the vows. They can't understand how they're taking the vows. So that's the idea of a den. Jetsokapa's root text says the following: Lingsun Kipa Pumeki Thema Kid Sama Lamani Samasarami. That's when he explains the den. So the first requirement he mentions is Lingsun Kipa Pumeki. Lingsun, you know what Ling means? Ling? I'll just yell, that's that. Can you hear okay?
I don't know how to get the speakers to work.
Turn a couple of buttons.
I've been pushing
okay, I'll talk louder. Ling Sun Gepa Pumiki. Gepa Pume means man or woman. Human. Has to be a human. Ling Sun means on the three continents. Okay, how many continents are there?
Seven.
There's four main continents, and then each main continent has a subcontinent. So there's 12 or 4, whichever way you want to do. Okay? Four main continents. North, south, east, west. Okay? We live on the southern continent. And Lingsun Kepa Pumeki means men or women, humans, of the three continents. Meaning, the first kind of being who's a human who cannot take Pratimoksha vows is someone who lives on the northern continent, which is known as Unpleasant South, Dharminya. What's the reason is that their lifespans are fixed. They always live to 500. Okay? They never die early. They have some kind of strange karma where they don't die early. So people don't get renunciation. And the reason that that continent is called Unpleasant Sound is that just before they die, they hear some voice from the sky saying, tomorrow's the day, sorry, it's no. and it's very unpleasant sound for them, you know, and then they die early. So through their whole lives, they have this pretty, they have some kind of feeling of stability or some kind of feeling of, what do they call that? Where you think everything's okay, like security. Because they're not going to die prematurely. And so they cannot get true renunciation. If you have true renunciation, you have to be aware of your death. The real, most basic reason to be a Buddhist is to be aware of your death. The minimum motivation is to be aware of your death. So they can't do it. So if your homework said, give me seven beings who can't take Pratimoksha vows, and cannot be a den for Pratimoksha vows, the first one would be someone who lives on the northern continent. Sama means somebody who's impotent in the sense that they cannot engage in sexual relations. And they cannot take Pratimoksha. There's a kind of an energy in the human being, either a male energy or a female energy. And And they are described in the Abhidharma, second chapter. In the Abhidharma in the second chapter, there are 22 powers or energies in the body which are discussed. And two of them are the male and female energies. And you might call it hormones or something, okay? But if you don't have them, or if there's something wrong with them, you cannot be a 10 for Pratimoksha Pals. Apparently, if you're deficient in either male or female energy, your mind cannot be strong-willed enough to keep about. Somehow that those hormones give you some kind of firm-mindedness or willpower to keep about. And they say that if you don't have those two powers, then you somehow lack sufficient willpower or decisiveness to keep about. So you have to have one of those two powers. Sama means a being who's incapable sexually, just doesn't have sexual energy. Samadhan, that's number two. Maning means a neuter. Okay, a neuter. There's 10 different kinds. 5 of them are female tending neuters, and 5 of them are male tending neuters. And basically, it's just someone who again, does not have either one of those energies. Or something's wrong with those energies. They don't really have that energy in its proper form, in the sense that they are neuter. Like they could have been born neuter, neither male nor female, or they could have been, they could have had an accident and lost their sexual organ or something like that. But somebody who's been neutered that way doesn't have that energy, doesn't have that hormonal energy to keep the vows. Okay? So that's three so far. Seni means hermaphrodite, meaning somebody who has both sexual organs at the same time. And they also, they don't have a pure sexual identity or energy, and that's required for the das. Seni, samadhamani, seni, solamani. Then he says so. So means what? La sopa.
Etc.
So means etc. Okay. And then you have to go through what are the exceptions. Let me see if I can remember. One is a samme, somebody who's committed a samme. What's a samme?
5 bad deeds.
Yeah, one of the 5 ultimately bad deeds, which are?
Killing
your
mother.
Killing your father.
Hurting.
Killing an arha.
Killing an arha.
What's an arha? Someone who's reached nirvana. What's nirvana? Permanent cessation of your mental
functions.
Yeah. Okay. Now, whether they have suffering or not is a big debate. If they have suffering, but not the truth of suffering, something like that. I mean, they can die, and they can have their heads cut off, like that, but they don't get upset. Okay. Which would be interesting. Place. Fourth one. Technically, it's called trying to draw blood from a Buddha in anger. So I guess that's to eliminate nurses who are drawing blood and stuff. Mm. Trying to hurt a Buddha. Trying, because you can't. And then the last one? Causing a schism in the Sangha during the time of the Buddha. So we can't do number 5. You know, during the time of the historical Buddha. We can do a Nyametama, which means a close one, but we can't do a real one. We can't do the real one. Right now, we can do something which is like 99% bad, which is splitting up people in a Dharma center, for example. But we can't commit the ultimate one. Only one person in history has done it. They're in the lowest power. Okay, that's how many. Like 5? Okay, 6 say Kutapsu Nepa. Kutapsu?
Kutapsu
Nepa.
Nepa.
Kutapsu?
Kutapsu
Nepa.
Nepa.
Kutapsu Nepa means someone, this is historical in India, I guess it could also happen nowadays, who hears there's going to be a Buddhist ordination ceremony. In fact, I had a lady last week who was like this. And she wants to write her PhD thesis about it. And that ceremony is secret, cannot be attended by anyone who's not taking the vows or giving the vows. And she wanted to know if she could, you know, like, stand behind a curtain and hear the whole thing, and then she could write about it for her doctoral thesis. And in ancient India, the idea was that someone would pretend to be taking vows just in order to hear, you know, what's it all about, and you know, how could they use it for their PhD thesis and stuff like that. And that's called Kutupsinepa. Ku means to rip off, to steal something. Kutupsinepa means to be somewhere with the intention, being an imposter, with the intention of stealing this knowledge for some lousy motivation like a PhD thesis. And instead of what? Renunciation. I mean, instead of taking them or learning them or studying them because you are fed up with the ups and downs of life. That's Kutupsinepa. Seven? Lota? Chen. Lota Chen. Okay, someone who really doesn't believe in
karma,
laws of karma, or
past
and future lives. Those are the two classic ones, also the three jewels, things like that. That would be Lopta Chen. Okay, and those are seven types of people who cannot support their state of mind and their body, either their state of mind or their body, and or both, okay, cannot support a pratimoksha path. They cannot take a pratimoksha path in this life. So I think all of us can take it, right?
Right?
All right, that's the discussion of the den. Okay, now we discuss a story here. Say, Dongwei Yu. Dongwei means to lose your vows. Yu means generally cause, but here it means what can make you lose your vows. Things that can make you lose your vows. It's a very depressing subject. I don't like this subject much. But we'll go through it just so you know what the rules are. Dongwei Yu, the ways you can lose your vows can be divided into two types. The first type are general ways of losing any pratimoksha vows. In other words, if you do one of these and it happens to be like five, it doesn't matter what vow you have, you'll lose it. And then there are specific ways to lose specific vows. And there's like three examples of those. You know, like for certain kinds of vows, you would lose that particular vow, but not a different kind of vow if you did that particular thing. So there's general ways to lose any vow. And then there's specific ways to lose specific vows. And that's the big division of two ways to lose your vows. So the root text says, Dongba Tongwei Yuan Yi Laba Pu Dan Shi Pu Dan. Say Laba.
Laba.
Pu.
Pu.
Laba.
Laba.
Pu.
Pu.
Laba means generally advice or instructions. Sometimes it means precepts. Here it means precepts. Pu is a, what's that word? What's that word for a polite word for a nasty thing? Euphemism, okay? Pu means to offer, okay? And lava pu means to give your vows back, formally. That's where you can either do it in front of another ordained person, or you can even do it in front of a Buddha statue, and there's a ritual, short ritual, where you say, okay, I can't keep these vows, and I formally give them back. The motivation for that he doesn't discuss, but in my own mind, you know, I see it like this. When you take most of the pratimoksha vows, you know, all except the first two, you swear to do so for the length of your life, before all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the Ten Directions. You know? I mean, you're making a solemn vow in front of these enlightened beings, and according to all according to any kind of Buddhist belief, they are there in the room. They are listening when you take the vows. And what's the only motivation you're allowed to have? I mean, is it you want to look nice, or you kind of like the other people who are monks and nuns, or you want to go along with your friends, what they're doing, or you want to seem to people to be more something, you know, what is it? I mean, the only motivation is that you're sick of this kind of life where your body is doomed, your relationships are doomed, your possessions are doomed, you know, your intellect is doomed, you're gonna end up senile if you live that long. You know, there's no future in any of it. There's no way that anything about this world can go right, because it's all created by karma and clashes. If those things are generating your world, everything has to screw up sooner or later. Just give it some time. Okay, if it's not screwing up now, give it another couple of weeks or 6 months or a year. You know, it cannot go right. You know, quit struggling to make it go right through external causes, because it cannot work. It will not work. Something will always go wrong. And that's renunciation. That's a recognition with which you take the vows. It doesn't seem to me possible to give the vows back if you still have any kind of understanding of what's going on. You know, because you took them to get out of that. And that doesn't get better. It's not like, you know, samsara suddenly gets nicer when you're 30 or 40 or something, you know. It doesn't work that way. It will always be screwy. And it will always be, everything will be, there's this African novel I had to read in high school. It's called Things Fall Apart. And it's very famous. It's just things fall apart, you know. And things fall apart, you know. Everything falls apart. So, and it doesn't change. I can't understand why anyone would give the vows back. That situation doesn't change until you use the vows to reach Nirvana and Buddhism. So I don't understand that. And the second major thing I'd say about it is that you can't judge those people who do give their vows. I've known great lamas, who I still consider great lamas, who have given their vows back. And they've gone on to do some other extraordinary thing, and maybe they have some extraordinary insight into the future and what they could do if they gave the vows back. Or maybe some tantric deity appeared to them and said, your problem is pride, I want you to appear to mess up in front of everybody so you can overcome your pride about being a monk. And I can imagine that that's possible. So I don't say that we can judge people, but I'd say that if you take them, and if that doesn't happen, then I can't understand any reason to give them back. It doesn't make sense if you took them for the right reasons. So that's the first reason. Say Shipa.
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 There's a couple of words in Tibetan for dying. This one is a little more exotic, okay? She means to die, but P means to move on, to transmigrate, okay? So Shipa is an idiom that means to die and go on. What it means is die, okay? Die and move on. Die and move on to your next life. Die and move, okay? And that, if you die and move, you lose how many of the eight kinds of vows?
All
of them, okay. remember where we are. We're talking about the general causes for losing any vow, any of the eight vows. Okay. What about a one-day vow? I think if you died halfway through the day, you'd lose it. The 10 is gone. Chini chun. Say chini. Chini. Chini.
Chini.
Chini.
Chini.
Chini. Sen means, normally sen means name. It can also mean mark, like a mark on the Buddha. But sometimes it means sexual organ. That's when Rinpoche says sign, that's what he's talking about. Sen means sexual organ. Ni means two. Chun means if they appear. And what it means is if you took a vow with only one sexual organ and then your body changed and you have two sexual organs, you would lose the vow. This is all over the Vinaya, so apparently it happened. Apparently things like this happened more often in the past. You know, apparently things like this were not unheard of in ancient India.
Do they have to be different?
I don't really know, but I think the assumption is that they're different. Because that would mess up the energy of either male or female.
But
is
it
okay
if you want to have three?
We'll have to debate this. By the way, those things are all covered in the more expensive thing.
So, yeah, on number three, Ni Chung, what's the meaning?
Ni means two, and Chung means they appear on your body.
Oh.
Say Len Sum Gyur.
Len
Sum Gyur.
Len
means, in this case, time, like one time, two times, three times. Okay. Sum means what?
Three.
Gyur means change. Okay. If you change sexes once, it's okay. You know, like if you're a gelong and your sex changes to female, you become a
Kilo-ma.
If you're a Getsul and you change to a female, you become a Getsul-ma. If you're a Gelo-ma, what happens?
You
become a Getsul. Okay. You become a Getsul. Because there is no Gelo-pa. Alright? So you can change sexes once and even twice, and you still keep a vowel. Okay? But if it happens three times, apparently, or more, apparently there's some kind of a...
Three strikes are out.
No respect. Well, going back to the... Well, I go back to twice. Were you architecting sex?
No.
No, I don't know. Somebody asked me, is it three or is it after three? I'll tell you the truth, I'm not sure. Anyway. Dalai Lama always says, I'll let you know when it happens. Say, Geza?
Geza.
Che.
Geza?
Geza. Che. Geza is a very specific concept. As Ge means virtue, Za means root. Like the root of virtue. And people have been, you know, people have translated it as like core of virtue or elementary virtue or elementary virtue or something like that. And I was in the monastery, we debated about it, I asked all my teachers, I couldn't see much difference between, I didn't understand what was your rudimentary virtue and what was not your rudimentary virtue, you know. Because this subject comes up a lot in the discussion of the paramitas, like when you get anger. Extreme anger at a bodhisattva or something can hurt your getsa. And lokta, wrong views, like this is all garbage. When you say this Buddhism stuff is all garbage, like I've met students who, you know, they got into a bad frame of mind and it got worse and worse and worse, and then they went to Rinpoche and said, this is all garbage, I give it up, you know, and they leave. That's getsa che. You cut your virtue root. Now, what's the difference between Getsa and Gewa? You know, virtue and virtue root. I can't get it very straight. I'm still working on it. I'll tell you the truth. Apparently, Getsa means your whole accumulation of virtue. And it's not like elementary virtues or something like that. It doesn't seem to mean core of virtue so much as your general accumulation of virtue through your life, for example. And if you get an extremely bad, wrong view, you somehow destroy that whole accumulation. And that's Getsa Che.
So,
Che means to cut, like Dorje, Chepa is the present tense, Chepa is the past tense. Dorje Che. Che means to be cut off. To cut off your root of virtue. Meaning, destroy your accumulated virtue, as far as I have been able to work it out with various lamas. Getsa Che. Those are general ways of losing your vows, those five. Now we'll go to some...
Did you have a question?
Yeah, in Theravada Buddhism, you can't become a monk if you're missing a limb. I don't know if that's true.
Maybe our monastic code is Theravada.
Okay, so...
And technically, if you have certain gross physical deformities, you're not supposed to become a monk. You're not supposed to make you a monk. I don't know, I don't think you, it's not listed as losing your vows if you become deformed after your
vows. What if you're walking and stepping on a landmine?
Yeah, I don't think you lose your vows. I have never seen it listed as a reason to lose your vows if you've already taken it. And I think in practice, I've seen many kinds of monks with many kinds of handicaps granted vows and kept them very nicely. So I think it might be a cultural thing. I think in ancient India, they didn't want to collect all the handicapped people in the country and all the retarded people, and there's certain ancient rules about who you can make a monk. But Jetsungapa doesn't go through all those. But there's a long, long list. And there's a point in the ordination ceremony where the assistant vow giver, who's called the Sangten, has to take the candidate to a room and ask him these like 30, 40 questions. You know, do you have this? Do you have this? Do you have this disease? Do you have this disease? Are you here to steal something? You know, do you have a large debt that you're avoiding by coming to the monastery? Are you in the service of someone that you're trying to run away from? You know, stuff like that.
How do you
I can't tell you all the details. they take care of that. These are the specific causes that can make you lose certain vowels. Say Nishu.
Nishu.
Malun.
Malun.
Derche.
Derche.
Nishu.
Nishu.
Malun.
Malun.
Derche. Nishu means 20 years old. Malun means didn't reach it. Derche means to find out. And this is a very specific thing. You thought you were 20, you have to be 20 years old to take Gemon vows, full month's vows. Okay? So if you thought you were 20 and took the vows, but you weren't 20 yet, and before you turned 20 you found out that you weren't 20, then you lose your vows. Okay? Then the vows disappear. Very interesting. Okay? You got it?
And if you didn't find out?
Then you would keep the vows.
Only find out before.
Yeah, before you turn 20. Counting time in the womb, the text says. Okay? Don't forget that those 9 months are considered, in Buddhism, they're considered lifetime. So when you're 3 months out of the womb, you can have your first birthday. Conception day. Anyway.
Okay. Is there a limit in age to give off?
Yeah, to take full month's vows, you must be 20. You have to be 20. You can't make that decision.
Maximum.
Oh, no, no maximum. And in fact, in Tibet, there's a custom for people to take them when they're 70 or something. Like people who've gone through the whole family life thing, but they want to die in the robes. And in fact, my first Tibetan teacher did that. So he was an aristocrat, a very famous aristocrat, a wealthy aristocrat. And he got in renunciation about 6 months before he died. No, and he wanted to die with his robes on. So he took his robes, and then his wife still took care of him because he was bedridden. And then every night she'd go out and sleep on the porch.
I was going to bring this up earlier with people taking it, going back to impotency.
Which is defined as not able to have sexual relations.
Could they be impotent now, but been able to perform when they're younger?
I'd have to check out the fine points, which are, you know, the Naya texts are 16,000 pages long. I think you have to have that energy when you
take the vows.
It's not listed as a reason to use the vows in this very brief text. Now, maybe in more detail.
The monk who died 6 months after taking the vows,
yeah.
Was there a provision made for his wife in terms of his wealth?
Normally she would get it. Yeah. I think Tibetans are very, and Tibetan Buddhism, don't forget, they are normally people with bodhisattva vows and with tantric vows, which is much different from the monks in the southern countries. You know, normally a monk in a Tibetan monastery has all three sets of vows. So your behavior, your motivation, is much more broad. You know, and really, it's the renunciation is why you're a monk. But normally you have bodhisattva vows, which mean you're supposed to take care of everybody. And if that means, for example, collecting wealth and using wealth, you have to. And that's a big difference between the southern and northern. Most monks in Tibetan monasteries have all three sets of vows. And there are certain provisions in the higher two sets of vows which require you to do things which, if you only have the lower vows, would be breaking those vows.
Do you know those also
have to be
20?
I do know. Yeah. She says yes. I don't.
What was the question?
Yeah, they do.
No, but what's the question?
For all that, you have to be 20.
Which seems to be a really wise rule, right? Because, I mean, in ancient India, you were halfway through your life. Say, Denshin.
Denshin.
Kelan.
Kelan. Denshin.
Kelan.
Kelan.
Ke-la means to take it up with your mouth. Ka means mouth, ke means with your mouth, la means to take it up. It's the Tibetan word for to agree to do something or to accept something. To agree to do something. Ke-la means to agree to do something. Dentia means here to have sex, to have sexual relations. And this is a specific way for a gay lokma, an intermediate nun, loses her vows, all her vows immediately, if she does this one action, which is only agreeing to have sexual relations with a man.
What about sexual relations with a woman?
Say again?
What about sexual relations with another woman?
The text I read said it with a man.
That's heavier than
a
That's
not
going to do that. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that if you break a root guy, you don't want to break a
normally, yeah.
So then this one is heavier than if it were a root guy.
Seems to be. Yeah. You're learning the debate grounds from very far. Say, Ninshak Be. Nin shak means one 24-hour period. Shak means one 24-hour period. Nin shak. Day means passes, finishes. So why do you lose your vowel? It's one 24-hour period. Yeah, this refers to the first two of the eight vowels. I'm sorry, first one. Right? Which is what? One day vowel. Okay, so very specifically, in the one-day vow, you lose it when the day finishes, when the sun comes up the next morning. And you can see the lines on your hand. And that's me right there. So here you have three specific causes for losing your vows in the case of a full monk, or in the case of a yellow monk, intermediate nun, and in the case of a one-day vow. Specific causes, specific ways to lose just that vow. Right, right. So that's why I say things that can make you lose a vow. Now there are two groups, there are two Hinayana groups that have that add two more causes. They say there's two other ways you can lose a vow. Those groups are the Sutras, which are the second of the four great schools of India, and self-transcendence. And there's a group called Niyopa, which means under the sun. And they live in some land which is like in central India or something. It refers to their geographical location. They are a group of the Vaibhashika, or you can call them detailists. And they add two more ways to lose a vow. Say tsatum.
Tsatum.
Chuma.
Chuma.
Tsatum.
Tsatum.
Chuma.
Chuma.
Tsatum means a pamba. What's a pamba?
Defeat.
There's five groups of vowels, right? For gelong or geloma. We had six because we split one of them into two. But there's five groups. This is that first group called the defeats. The very most serious. With a full monk, there's how many?
Four.
Boy, went away quickly. And with a full nun, there's eight. Okay. So the very most serious four for a full monk and the very most serious eight for a full nun. It's called a tsatu. And chuma means if you have a tsatu, if one of them, if you break one of those first groups of vows, the very most serious ones. So according to these two groups, if you commit one of those, you lose all your vows. Say damchu.
Damchu.
Nirpa.
Nirpa.
Damchu.
Damchu.
Nirpa.
Nirpa.
Damchu means the holy dharma, meaning the Buddhist dharma, Buddha dharma. Nirpa means if it declines in the world. If in the whole world Buddhism like starts to disappear, then they say, these two schools say, you would personally lose your vows also. Your vows would disappear. Buddhism in general disappeared in the world. Your vows would also disappear. The other schools say, come on, that is the holy dharma. And if some person still has vows and still keeping them well, then the holy dharma didn't disappear in the world, did it? So then there's a disagreement among the schools. These two viewpoints are not accepted by the school of Vinaya in Tibet, which is called the Kashmiri Detailist School. Our Vinaya follows the detailist school of what's called Kashmiris, of northern, northwest India, of those days.
So this school says what about a month and a half?
You lose all your vows.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
hey, good question. Let's do that.
What did she say?
She says, well, what does happen to you in the school that we do accept if you do break one of your root vows? Most certainly. Kachichira Mawanam means the Kashmiri detailist, which is what we are. Domden Satum Chuwama means if somebody with four monks or nuns vows commits one of the defeats, Bulun Nonde Shindudu. Bulun means to have a debt. Bulun means to have a debt. Nonden means to be rich. Nor means wealth. Den means having. And related obviously to the word Norbu, for example. Shin means the metaphor. You can use the metaphor of that. So they say a person who, for example, breaks the vow against killing, they become like a rich man with a big debt. Okay, I always give the example of my boss. He's very apropos nowadays. He started out with $50,000. He built up to $150 million. He's down to about, I don't know what, let's say $50 million. And he owes about $5 million. Okay. And he doesn't have any cash, and the company might fold because he's worth $50 million, but he can't liquidate $50 million, so he can't pay the bills. So that's bullen nonden shin. Okay, that's if you have the vows at all, you are like a very, very wealthy person. If you broke one of the root vows, in that sense, you really have a huge debt. But the debt is much less than what you have. And in Chonidakra Shit, who's the commentator? Dharmabhadra says, I get confused. Dharmabhadra says, you are poor from the point of view of, if someone says, how's your vow against killing doing? You have to say, I'm broke. You know, I've really messed up. And if they say, how's your other vows doing? You have to say, I'm really a lucky person. I mean, I'm rich in vows because I'm keeping all of them. So from this point of view, you're like a pauper. And from this point of view, you're like a rich man. Okay? But you don't, according to the school that Jetsu Kapa follows and that we follow, and all the traditions in Tibet follow, you don't lose all your vows. You don't lose all your vows. It's very, very, very serious. It destroys that vow. I mean, it practically wipes out your vows. It damages that vow irreparably. You cannot ever bring it back to its full strength as it was before. And I believe it's only if you don't hide it that you don't lose your vows. You have to admit it to people. And then all sorts of bad things happen to you in the monastery. Like you get devoted and all sorts of things. But you're not thrown out of the monastery, you don't lose your vows.
Mike, what kind of details are you
saying? Yeah. I'll write it, okay? How do you spell that?
We were thinking English spelling.
I'll do both.
What's your first name?
Generally, Kache means Muslim. I mean, in modern Tibet, it has come to mean Muslim. But in ancient Tibet, it meant someone from Kashmir. And most of the Muslims who came into Tibet were traders from the Kashmir area. And there was a large Muslim community in Tibet, especially in Pasan. They were very well accepted and people got along very well. Nowadays they're getting much more powerful in Tibet and there's some problems. There were Tibetan Muslims. They're very interesting. I've met them and spoken to them. They're very interesting. Okay, just scratching, man. Alright. Kachin Chekamal. Maybe a good time to take a break. We don't have much more. Track is really just nirvana, which is the permanent ending of your mental afflictions based on having seen emptiness directly. Because you saw emptiness directly, you're able to remove your mental afflictions permanently. Then you can either sit there or you can go get your rear end up to the Bodhisattva chair. Okay? And there's this whole sweet thing in the scriptures about how the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas knock these people out of this. It's called peace. It's called, they're in this very blissful state where they don't care about other people, and they're just sitting there and enjoying nirvana. And then there's this beautiful description of how the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas wake them up and get them to go up to the Bodhisattva track, what they whisper in their ears and stuff. It's very sweet. Like, how does it happen? What kind of karmic cause would make you be in this bliss, nirvana, and then somebody's like trying to push you. Like, get up, let's go. Gotta get to the Bodhisattva track. Bodhisattva track, first path, true renunciation aimed at yourself and others, which is otherwise known as
bodhicitta.
Okay. The wish for enlightenment, but now you know it means the wish for total enlightenment. And then second path is a bodhisattva's understanding of emptiness and direct. Third path, a bodhisattva's direct perception of emptiness. Fourth path, a bodhisattva going through the process of removing their mental afflictions and their obstacles to ambitions. And then fifth path, total enlightenment. So those are the three enlightenments. Two of them are nirvanas. One of them is pure and total enlightenment. When you reach nirvana, it's just a state of mind. Your mind is totally clear, clean. No dirty thoughts ever again, nothing. No irritation, no stressful thought, no unhappy thought. Your mind cannot be shaken out of a very, very stable kind of contentment and happiness ever again, period. Cannot happen. The outside world can be all chaos, and it probably will be for a while. Your boss is still screaming, the company's still going under the belly up, friends are still being bad to you sometimes, all sorts of things can still happen. Your finances can go up and down, your health can go up and down, but your mind is just totally like in this golden window. And nothing can shake it out of that state. You are in a state of total contentment. You can never really be irritated or anything again. That's nirvana. And then enlightenment is where you go on beyond that. And you have this experience of taking other people. Your whole viewpoint of being in that golden window is to turn around and bring other people there. The whole feeling that you have as you're entering it is that you stop and you hesitate and you look back and you think, I should bring other people here. Do you hesitate and then stop, not enter it? No, you enter it. But as you enter it, you're thinking, I'm doing this so that other people will meet me and they'll sense what I have and then I'll be able to teach them and take them to that same place. So that's bodhicitta. You're thinking, I will enter nirvana and I will stay in nirvana and I will reach that state of mind. Other people will smell it and they'll be attracted and then I'll teach them how to do it. And that becomes a motivation which turns into full enlightenment. And if you do it with a tantric teaching, if you've had initiation and if you've had a proper transmission from personal transmission from a qualified tantric lama, then you can do that in this life. You can do it very quickly, very quick and very subtle, and very if you don't do it just right, it's a disaster. So it's a very delicate thing. That last step of accelerating it. Needs total purity and devotion, and if you don't pull it off, then it's a disaster. So that's a very secret thing and a very private thing. I can't talk about it. Somebody had a question.
Yeah, we just did on the homework and on the quiz the consequences and the the environmental consequences of the two, And you were saying that when you reach nirvana, you can have all these things going on around you, but it doesn't affect you. But the fact that they're going on around you, how is that related to the consequences and the karmic results that we just went over?
Yeah, good. It's the external world is still absolutely a result of bad karma and mental afflictions. So You didn't purify that yet. All you purified was your own mind. So your body is still getting old. Your relationships are still screwing up. Your business is still going up and down. Your finances are going up and down. Your body's getting sick or not getting sick. You're meeting people who scream at you or don't scream at you. Your mind is totally holy. But other people see whatever they have the karma to see, and they react to you whatever way they have the karma to see. And so it's possible that a person could reach nirvana and still be embroiled in controversy and people still attacking them. And, you know, and in fact, it often happens with religious figures. But from their point of view, in their own mind, they don't have any hatred or any bad feeling, or they're incapable of it. Because they, I mean, if you want to know the punchline, because they understand the emptiness of the situation, but perfectly. And they've trained themselves not to respond to it. But that's a long story. That's a different claim.
But it's their karma or your karma?
Well, what you see is your karma. What they see is their karma. They are forced by their karma to see a mind, to enjoy a mind, to live in a mind which is totally free of any kind of mental affliction. They cannot get mad. They cannot hate anyone. They cannot be jealous. They cannot even be irritated or stressed out again, period. But they can be on the Titanic, and the Titanic can be going under. And they are doing what they have to do, but they're not feeling bad or hurt or stressed out or irritated or agitated or anything.
Are they safe?
Not necessarily. I mean, the first Dalai Lama in his commentary, Abhidharma, relates the story of many arhats who suffered terrible deaths. Udayana himself, for whom the Wheel of Life was painted, suffered a terrible death. It's not, he didn't have any mental afflictions, but his body was murdered. So arhats are in this weird schizophrenia where the mind is in total happiness and contentment, but the body is still going through a lot of disasters, just like us. Yeah.
So, how does feeling compassion for someone, if you're an arhat and you see someone suffering, then do you feel some kind of that pain, which would not be contentment and happiness then?
Right. I debated this. You know, I had the honor of being the first person. It was my turn to debate Pabongkor Rinpoche when he took his Geshe exam. So I was a senior monk in our house who wasn't a Geshe yet. So I had to be the first one. And that was the question I asked. You know, I said, how can a Buddha be aware of other people's suffering and not feel some kind of mental distress? I mean, how can an enlightened being be aware of other people's pain and not feel some sort of pain themselves, you know, empathize? And we had this huge debate. We had a long debate. And all these Geshes got up and joined. And I think at the end what we all decided was... which is how it happens in a debate, was that they're aware of your suffering, but all they feel is compassion, and that compassion is a kind of bliss for them. You know, that compassion is a kind of good feeling for them. I mean, it's a kind of a sweet sadness where they're aware of your suffering, they're very, very concerned about it, but it doesn't make them feel any pain. They love you, and they want you to be free from suffering, but the emotion to them is some kind of sweetness. They can be aware of your suffering and not be in suffering themselves.
Well, that total detachment.
I don't know. Detachment kind of, to me, seems like they don't care, and it's not like that. They really care.
They care, but at the same time, you don't care because it's emptiness.
Because it's empty, you should care.
Right. You should care to want to free them. Right?
Yeah. But not being attached, that's a delicate idea. You've got to be careful. We got to talk more about that. Yeah.
You mentioned once about repairing vows that have hours.
Yeah. Yeah. We're going to have it in the long rim, which is coming up after this class. We're going to go through the four powers.
Do you restore these vows through the four powers?
No.
Or do you have to
do Chöden Drapa Shedup says... the ritual for restoring pratimoksha vows, especially for the higher vows, is the sojong ritual. Is the bi-weekly, every 2 weeks. Yeah.
Two months.
Two times a month. you have a ceremony to restore your vows. And that's a method for restoring your vows. And then Chöde Dapa Shenu says, what happens if you can't get the sojong? Do the four powers do the same thing? He says, absolutely yes. He says, you can do the four powers anytime. And in fact, when you break a vow, you must repair it immediately. If you have any means to do so, the karma doubles every 24 hours or so. And it's exponential. So you must open it up, admit it to somebody, and then immediately take steps. I like to do it right after I do the bad deed. I do the bad deed, and then I'm doing the four powers within about 5 minutes. And admit it to somebody. Try to straighten it out. Try to remove the power. You have to act immediately. It has some kind of very instant exponential growth in the karma. It's very well known. So it's important to try to stop it immediately before it grows too strong.
Nip it in the butt.
What's that?
Nip it in the butt.
Yeah, nip it in the butt.
There was a t-shirt we started.
The t-shirt I carry around a little stupid to confess to. And every time he had a bad thought, he would get off his horse. I mean, they'd be traveling on horseback, broad dragging from Pasa, it's like a 3-day trip, and it would take them like 20 days. here's this great, pure, spotless Indian pundit, who every time he had the slightest bad thought about somebody, he would stop and get off his horse and put the stupid there and do his confessions right there. And his entourage used to get a little irritated with him. Can we get there?
And they did confess. He was one of them.
Yeah. Sometimes these are the two results of keeping your vows. And I worry about this class. This class didn't kind of come out the way I thought it would, the way I hoped it would. I thought by the end of this class, everyone would be inspired to, everyone would, we'd probably have somebody shaving hair at the bottom of the stairs, I thought it would come out like that. I don't think you've got this overwhelming urge to take ordination.
Class is over.
Somehow I thought you'd at least get a little taste of it. And you don't have to take full ordination. In fact, it's a very bad idea if you're not totally ripe for it. And very few people are. It's a very, very bad idea if you're not totally ready for it. But I'm going to try to talk you into taking at least lay vows. Okay? Lay vows meaning very simple, fight, come on. No killing, no stealing, no pure, straight, clear adultery with another person's wife or husband. No lying about seeing empty stuff. No drinking. You can keep those. And very, very, what I'm trying to say is that you can get to that nirvana if you keep these vows. It's very interesting. People always coming up to me and saying, I've been meditating for 10 years, nothing's happening. I've been doing my tantric sadhana every morning, I didn't miss a day, nothing's happening. I can't concentrate, my back hurts, I can't keep my mind on this visualization I'm supposed to be doing. I don't feel any sweetness in my life or any great. I'm not seeing angels every night come down to me during my prayers, and Manjushri hasn't appeared to me yet, and nothing's popping. Really, if you're doing really good spiritual work, it should be like popcorn, and things just going off all the time. Great, wonderful things all day long, like boom, 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 boom. These great things happening. And then you get in these long dry spells, and nothing's happening at all. And you say, why? I've been trying to do everything the way I'm supposed to do. And I always tell people, go back to your, especially with tantric stuff. If you're not happy, if you're doing some sadhana for 10 years or 5 years or 2 years, and it's just like these long, empty words, and it's boring, and you can't, nothing's happening, and it's not very much fun. And go to Tsai Chu and sit through this 2-hour thing, and nothing happens. I always tell people, go back to Pratimoksha. The secret, the key, is in your Pratimoksha vows. Take some Pratimoksha vows. Have that invisible cloak on you, called the Pratimoksha vow. And it has, honestly, really, truly, it has some it's like a super, it's like a hidden power or something. It's a hidden energy that changes everything about your spiritual practice. If you take them, if you take on this invisible energy, which covers your body like a cloak, and if you keep them, it affects your spiritual body immensely. You know, things start popping. Things start happening. I would almost assert in public, it's the unassertable in the secret teachings, because that you don't need an initiation. People ask me, should I go take another initiation? I say, I don't think you don't even need any initiations. If you keep your pratimoksha perfectly well, you will meet that deity, and they will take you and initiate you. You know, you don't have to go to, you know, on the A train, wait for this guy to come from India. Keep your pratimoksha, take those vows, keep them really, really sincerely, which is fun. It's not a drag. I mean, try to be honest at work. It's very refreshing. I've been trying it real hard to sleep. I mean, there's things that I wasn't supposed to tell my boss. You know, he wrote me a memo praising me for something I didn't do. And I went to him, I said, you know, it's the only nice thing you said to me this week, but I have to admit I didn't do it, you know. And he's like, well, but you're great anyway, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? That's the kind of thing that happens. I mean, if you're just totally honest. Just keep them. It's fun. It's really fun. It's a lot more fun than trying to hide things. And you get these incredible results. There's some kind of combination of having that invisible vow that you don't get if you don't have the vow. It permeates your being. And there's some kind of catalyst created. If you have that and you keep them nicely, something amazing will happen to you. I promise. It really does. And it's sweet. And it's wonderful. And it's what you always hope for when you came to a Buddhism class. You know, it's not like these boring tests and quizzes and more facts. You know, this is like real thing happening. And try it. Just try it. If you don't like it, you can always give them back.
Oh, yeah, after that.
We got some food.
That's the long
story. This is Lama who said, you know, everything you've been doing so far didn't work, so might as well try it. You know? You had a question.
Most recently, that is, if you feel your place of work and expectations for you to be this cynical, mean person that you've always been, is that maybe the time to say goodbye to that sort of place? If you don't, if it's so ingrained in the way you're.
It depends on the answer is in the Bodhisattva vows, and they say, take an action which fits your capacity. So if you feel that you can be strong enough, then you should stay there and learn from it. You know, it's much more invigorating to be pure in mud, which is the idea of a lotus. You know, a lotus always grows in the filthiest kind. If you've ever been to India and see where the lotuses grow, I've never picked a lotus because I could not get to the lotus. Because it's always in this big pool of crap, you know. You can't get to them. They're always growing about 20 feet away in this big pool of ugly, horrible poop. And that's why a lotus is so important in Buddhism. A bodhisattva shines in the worst crap, you know. I mean, a bodhisattva can really do their thing in the worst kind of office, surrounded by really lousy people and doing really cynical things. And that's when you can really show your stuff. And so if you have the strength, stay there. If you find that it's affecting you and you can't prevent it, and you find yourself not being able to resist those temptations to be cynical and other things, then you have to be then you must get out. Mm-hmm. So there's this idea in Bodhisattva, Shantideva says about the perfection of giving. He says, don't give away your arm at the beginning because you'll regret it later. He says, start out with some vegetables, okay? No, very sensitive. Start with carrots and potatoes. Try to give a potato. And then when you're ready, a real bodhisattva can reach into their eye socket and rip out their own eye and hand it to someone if they ask for it. They actually have the willpower to reach in their own eye socket and rip it out and give it to someone. And not feel the slightest disturbance about it. Like, oh, you want my eye? Okay. I mean, but he says, don't do it at the beginning. You know, you got to build up Says start with vegetables. It really does
doesn't
say that.
Happen to
you all. Have to do it, you have to cast it. It's a very important bodhisattva principle. If you overdo it, you'll quit. You know, many people do that. Say, oh, I'll give all my money to this lama, you know, and then 3 weeks later they're like, man, what did I do, you know? And they blow it. You know? You got a question?
Yeah. What's the actual moral progression for starting, you know, being where I am now, which would be just being a layman and taking ordination?
Well, we talked about Nyeme Punzok, right? Nyeme Punzok means the ideal way. The ideal way is take your ginyan, just take your layman's class, and when you've done pretty well with them and you feel like you're ready to go on, you take your novice class, which is like 36 vows if you count it that way. 10 vows if you count it the simple way. And then if you feel strong enough with that, then you take your full Gilman vows. That's the normal, that's Nyeme Punzok. And it starts with a, and then between the Gezel and the Genyen, you take a vow to, you take a commitment, Rabjun commitment, to leave the family line. You say, I'm going to give up on the family line. And that's the normal. But I know that Rinpoche, for example, there was a 10-year period when he only ordained one person. And he's very, you know, I think that's very wise. He wants people to be totally ready to do it. And it's very, very wonderful. And you will have to do it sooner or later. You mustn't do it this time, okay? It's very wonderful if you can do it. It's really, really good. It doesn't solve all your problems. You know, changing your suit. Doesn't change a single inch of your mind, but it's a commitment, and it helps. So I'd say start with Ganyan vows and keep them for like a year or two. Really strict, and keep thinking about it. And then when you're really, really ready, then go to Rinpoche and he'll say, nah. And then he'll say, can I come back and ask in a year? And he'll say, okay. And you know, and then if you prove that you're really serious, good, but to give them up is really, really terrible. So, you know, I think the real, they say there's one great thing about samsara. You know, it's in the scriptures. It says samsara is, I wanted to say sucks, but I don't want to curse. They say samsara is like that. But there's one great thing about samsara. They say, you know, all the scriptures say there's one wonderful thing about samsara, is that sooner or later it will reveal its true nature to you. You know, sooner or later it will tell you the complete truth about its own nature. You know, so sooner or later your life will screw up big time. You know, and you know, sooner or later life will reveal itself to you. You know, you have these little fragile, lousy happinesses right now, and sooner or later they'll get smashed by samsara. And then you'll say, oh man, you know, it was all right, and now I have to take ordination. But keep it in mind. You know, semjakshu, they say, but keep it in mind. I mean, there'll come a time when you're ready, when it's very, very comfortable. And I hate this thing in the West of thinking about it as like a punishment or scourging yourself or, you know, oh, I can't have ice cream anymore, you know, I can't watch movies, you know. It's not like that. It's like very joyful. It's very cool. It's very fun. I mean, if you really go to work and really be truly honest for one day, try it. You know, it's really kind of fun, and people smell it, and the whole place starts to work better. It's really weird. Just try. It's a lot more fun. It is fun. It's not like some, you know, I can't do that, I can't do that. It's not like that. Take layman vows, please. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to ask you, when are you going to have layman vows?
I think we're going to try to get Rinpoche to come here in November. We're negotiating. It's very hard to get him to go anywhere.
If he's taking it, can you take it?
No. Oh. It's a pratimoksha. It's jisitsoipa until you die. You don't have to take them again. You can't take them again. Bodhisattva vows you can take all the time, and secret vows. But if you got it, unless you have one of those causes to give it up. Unless you die, or etc. Okay, last thing on your homework. There's a colophon to the text, which is where Jetsokapa says, I wrote this book. You know, or somebody says, Jetsokapa wrote this book. The great poet Jetsokapa wrote this book. And what else did he Krishna said, there's something in there. Anyway, then Mucchidhammapada, which is kind of cool, he explains why his name is Sankara, which I've never seen before. And you've seen these people translate onion, Mr. Onion or something. Song does mean onion, but apparently it doesn't have anything to do with that. Song is the name of a river that goes through a province of Tibet called Dokhan. And because Jetsongkhapa was born in that area of that river, he was called Tsongkhapa. So that's one thing he says. Oh, and then he gets into an explanation of why did Jetsongkhapa name his book the essence of the ocean of discipline. Okay, the essence of the ocean of discipline. And the explanation is as follows. The discipline part you had in the first class. Do you remember the two parts of why Vinaya is called Vinaya? Dulwa. There were two parts.
To tame the wild horse.
Tame your...
The sense of your mind.
Yeah, that was number two. Tame your sense powers. No, you'll no longer be living in the world of the senses exclusively, which is ice cream and sex, okay? And then... and then what's the first one? Nyamontu. Which is what? It controls your mental afflictions. It destroys your mental afflictions. Okay? If you keep Vinaya, it's dulva, or discipline, in the sense of it knocks out your mental afflictions, and it controls your senses. That's the first... That's why he calls it the essence of the ocean of discipline. That's the discipline part, dulva, Vinaya. Why is it called an ocean? Dhammapada says it's called an ocean because understanding in detail all these principles about what you're supposed to do, what you're not supposed to do, and what you're allowed to do, you know, things like that. The great structure of the Vinaya precepts, the great detail of them, is like the ocean. I mean, to get to the bottom of it is extremely difficult. You would have to devote a lot of study to understand every aspect of the Vinaya. You know, to really understand why you should do this thing like confession, why you shouldn't do this thing like hurting other people, why you're allowed to do this thing like dancing after Gagye, which happened last week, for 8 days, you're allowed to goof off. You know, why you're allowed. All the details of those three are in the... To really grasp all the fine points, it's like an ocean. It can take you a long time. 16,000 pages to study. In the canon, much less the commentary. Now, why does he call it essence? The ocean is famous in Tibet for being the source of what? You know? It was believed that all jewels came from the bottom of the ocean. All kinds of jewels. Because coral came out of the bottom of the ocean, things like that. Coral is very valued in Tibet. It's like number one jewel in Tibet. So they said, I guess all jewels come from the bottom of the ocean. And the most essential jewel in all the world is what? According to Asian belief.
Fulfilling.
Well, really, it's a diamond, but there's also this other, that's true, but the other jewel called the Wishtun jewel, Yishinomu. Okay? Yishinomu. And this is some kind of jewel that if you find one and if you rub it a certain way, it's like an Aladdin's lamp. If you rub it a certain way and put it in a certain place and if you make a wish to it, you get whatever you wish. It gives you your wishes. So this is supposed to be the ultimate jewel, the essence of the jewel. The essence of the ocean. It's the ultimate jewel, and since all jewels come from the ocean, this is the essence of the ocean. So what is the wish-giving jewel of the night? And then that's the end of this class.
Enlightenment.
No, understand this. It's the jewel and not the wish. It's the thing that gives you your wish. It is the Aladdin's lamp and not the thing you wish for.
The vow.
Yeah, cool. Pratimoksha vow. They are the wish-giving jewel. I mean, you cannot imagine now what you can get from them. I mean, you have to keep them to find out. It's very, very cool. What I mean is, you cannot at present moment imagine how cool it would be to keep them and get those things happening to you. I mean, what will happen to you cannot imagine right now. You really can't imagine. You have to keep them to find out. It's something no one can convey to you in words. You have to take them and keep them And then things will happen to you that no one could ever describe to you, and that you would never even have dreamed of. And that's the nation of Christ. And that's my Vinaya.
It's much different to take the vows and keep it than to just live.
Extremely different. Totally different effect. That's one big principle of Vinaya. You know? Some kind of catalyst, having them in your being. Having them form in your being and then protecting them and feeding them has a totally different effect than if you didn't ever take them. And if you did the same things. Mm-hmm. Totally different. Okay. Meditate on that for like a few minutes. Okay? And then... just rejoice. I don't think anyone's got a good Vinaya class in America up to now. Maybe that's kind of egotistical to say, but I'm not sure that anyone's studying Vinaya. Maybe a few people. But to really have a pure Vinaya class, and to really appreciate what could happen if you took them and kept them, I think it's a very precious understanding to have in your mind. And we're very fortunate to have done it. So think about it. We're going to have, for dessert, we're having 3 long room classes after that. From Jetso Kappa's own personal life. But just rejoice, okay? Supposedly, if you're happy about doing a great thing, which you just did, it enhances it a lot. It's a lot more energy. So just meditate for a few minutes. Don't think about leaving. Think about how lucky we are that we did it, you know? And that someone in America is rejoicing about this holy thing called taking the vows and keeping it, okay?